Hey, Sean.
Yeah?
Did you know I have a star in my crystal ball?
Really?
Yeah, it's a lot like listening to Arctic Rising by Tobias Bukell on Audible.com, only slightly more smelly.
Is that so? Is it also like having your book run by a ship while jumping on a pumpkin?
What?
Never mind. Maybe our listeners should check out Arctic Rising on audible.com to support this purple podcast.
How do they do that?
Well, they can either climb on a doll on a poster with a dart stuck in a spook.
Or they can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and sign up for a free 1 month trial membership today. Doing so supports this podcast. Plus, you get a free audiobook out of the deal, which is pretty darn windy, no?
Indeed, and it would make more sense in this glorious advertisement.
Audible.com, bringing happiness to Seattle since 14th of October, 1066.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate! It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 99.
Traveling across the desert on wings of sand.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And we have with us today Parvati K. Tyler, author of Shadow on the Wall. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I just realized today is the our 99th episode, and the person who put a blurb on your book, and I'm going to say the name wrong, Masno al-Mosiki?
Masno al-Mosiki, yes, is one of the people who put a blurb on, but I think you're thinking of Dr. Naif, who began the 99.org.
Yes, that's right, and it seemed rather fitting that you're the 99th and the 99 all at once.
Absolutely, and for anybody who's listening, Dr. Naif and the 99.org is phenomenal, and you can check out the first graphic novel in the series for free, so go check him out.
Yes!
Jen's
yes,
soul
yes, yes.
just, like, lit up.
Yes, it really did. I wasn't able to get the comics, but I got the crossover with the Justice League, and
yes.
it was fantastic, and I really enjoyed it. I have a very small comic book dealer here, so
well, if you go straight to their if you go straight to their website, they you know you can get the digital comics right there online, but the first one is just a PDF. I'm not sure what a PDF or some kind of embedded document in the website, and the first one is free. You can just read it and enjoy it and get to know the awesome characters that Naif dreamed up.
Awesome.
That is awesome. But we're not here to talk about that. I just thought that no. was a rather amusing coincidence.
Yeah.
And of course I got the names wrong, which is very embarrassing.
No, it's okay. It's, you know, it's exciting when there are people who are excited about your work and you can be excited about their work. So, you know, I enjoy talking about their stuff and am thankful when they talk about mine.
Yeah, it was really cool when I saw that. I was like, whoa, this person liked this book. And like, I hadn't even read anything else about the book. I looked at that and I was like, well, we're going to interview this person.
Well, like, thank you. Excellent.
So, first things first, before we get to the book, what kind of drew you into writing and why genre fiction in particular, or rather sort of, I guess, superhero-y fiction?
Well, this particular project was a challenge that a friend of mine put out on his blog. He had discovered that the stats on his blog were equal parts people from somewhere in the Middle East and equal parts people who had found him by searching for superhero names.
That's an odd combination.
Yes. So he came up with the logical deduction that therefore all people in the Middle East love superheroes and put out a challenge on his blog that we needed a Middle Eastern superhero and, you know, was accepting entries, and there was no prize. It wasn't like a real competition or anything, but there were five or six of us who did it. And I got about 5,000 words into writing this, you know, just kind of silly one-off thing with a friend that I was doing, and realized that I had a whole lot more to say than I thought I did. So I just kept going.
And somewhere along the line, you ended up with a novel.
Somewhere along the line, I ended up with about 130,000 words, which is now chopped down to the 55,000 that is in the actual book itself.
Wow. It's quite the edit.
My editor is awesome.
That's a huge edit. It's like cutting it in half. Wow.
I have, some authors have what they refer to as writer's block. Mm-hmm. I have writer's Tourette's. So I can literally sit down and churn out 20 pages for you about the main character looking out the window.
Wow.
No one wants to read this.
No one alive, anyway.
I mean, I have characters eating their breakfast for chapters upon chapters. So fortunately, I have people who will go through it and say, all right, this seems like it might be important, but can we cut this 15 pages out?
Well, I guess it helps you, too, as the author, because I'm assuming it's not just like long descriptions of breakfast being eaten. It's like dialogue and kinds of things going on. But at the same time, you as the author are sort of getting into your characters in a way that I suppose helps the finished product, even if we never see those materials.
Yeah, I try to think of it as writing exercises. I don't do writing classes or writing exercises or flash fiction, which a lot of authors do in order to kind of keep their momentum going and their muse fed. Instead, I just write, you know, thousands and thousands of useless words, but it gets me in touch with my characters and it kind of helps me hone exactly what it is I'm trying to say, so that hopefully the end result is a very tight and effective product instead of something that just meanders.
So we're going to move into the book now, because this is actually perfect. We can kind of go into the book. How would you describe this book to somebody who walked into a bookstore and you were standing there and was too lazy to read the cover blurb and said, tell me about this book?
It's a Muslim superhero novel.
God, that was too easy.
I mean, come on, did you look at it?
This is true.
Well, we know what it is.
You want my elevator pitch? It's a Muslim superhero novel. And instantly everybody goes, really?
Say what
and
now?
Yeah. More, so.
Well, okay, so let's kind of run with that. Because actually, Jen and I had a number of questions, because it is a Muslim superhero book, but it's also dealing with a particular, what's the word I'm looking for, problematic or a particular area of, I guess, fundamentalist Islam.
Yes.
In terms of the kinds of issues that are going on, we've a lot of oppression, very, very sort of, I don't know if hard right is the way you would describe it politically, but the kinds of things that I guess Americans are terrified of, or like terrorists are going to take us all and eat our brains or whatever. but there is, and I thought it was very interesting that you are, on the one hand, you're writing a book that is about Muslim characters and Muslim people, some of them good, some of them bad, some of them in the middle, but also a book that's criticizing the very, very fundamentalist, oppressive side of Islam, that small segment of it. And this seemed to me that, like, you've got two audiences that you're competing against, or maybe not competing against, but that these are two kind of audiences that are going to be, I guess, turned off by some kind of dogma of their own. And I was curious, mm-hmm. What for you, did you find this as, when you were approaching this, did you think, like, my gosh, people are going to hate this book and I'm going to have problems finding an audience? Or were you thinking, you know what, this is not going to be an issue, that this for me is, I'm not going to alienate readers, because this is, I guess, an honest book about issues.
I'm very careful in marketing and in discussing the book to make sure to let people and potential reviewers know that this is not a lighthearted romp. This isn't the next supernatural romance. This is a dark book, and it deals with dark themes in explicit detail.
Yeah.
It's an adult book. And it's intended for adults who are prepared to put the time and energy in to really think about these things. And a lot of times, people aren't, and that's fine. People want to read because they want to get away from these things and they want to enjoy life. I hope that you can do that as well in the book. But the overarching themes and many of the plot points are dark. And that was done on purpose. And one of the things that was really important to me to highlight was you can pick up this book and you can place it in the Bible Belt and use fundamental militia Christians and have a similar book. Mm-hmm. You can pick it up and put it in any oppressive regime and have a similar book. But when you look at the characters, when you really get down to the nitty gritty of what each character stands for, what their role is, they're people. Mm. I think that Rakai is a very relatable person. I think his take on religion, he is Islamic, but he's moderate Muslim. He practices, but he's not devout the way people assume it means to be Muslim. I think that most of my Islamic friends who've read it relate very well to Rakai and say, yeah, this is kind of how my friends are. And, you know, this one person might be a little bit more religious and this one person might be a little bit less. But most of us are thinking things through, looking at the world through a lens similar to the lens Rakai is using. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, for myself, questions about God and what is my place in the world, that these aren't unique questions to the Middle East. But I got very tired after 9/11 about hearing all of the horrible things that were coming out of the Axis of Evil and how, you know, anybody in hijab was guaranteed strapping down explosives and trying to take out our shopping malls. And I know that that's just not true. I know that at the end of the day, most people are just people who are trying to figure out how to get through their day and pay their bills and maybe make a friend and learn something new and do something entertaining and give something back to the world. Most of us aren't, you know, these evil masterminds that the news and a lot of literature and entertainment was putting out. And I wanted to present a superhero story because that's where the inspiration came from, but a superhero story where the bad guy wasn't necessarily the people. The bad guy was the institution.
Right.
And in doing that, I had to take a lot of time to look at what motivated the characters who were the antagonists. Mayor Yilmaz, I think I can give away very easily that he's, you know, an evil mastermind who should be destroyed and, you know, takes down the city and he's our supervillain. But he's also just an archetype. He's a stand-in. He's a paper cutout of what the real evil in the story is. And when you look at the characters of Daria and Isik, I certainly found them myself in reading, that there were times when I would look at them and say, yeah, I kind of get where they're coming from.
Damn it, woman. You're at like one of my last questions right now. You've already covered everything.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In the interview. No,
totally. All right. Well, it was nice meeting you.
No,
that
really was one of my questions. Daria and Isik, the way you just said it, because I was trying to think, I was like, okay, who are the sort of the villains of this character of this book? And it's not the specific people. I mean, yes, you could say that Daria and Isik, their actions are some of the most vile in the book. But they have backstory that makes them, if not sort of understandable or not relatable, but more understandable. I mean, you can get it. You can see how they became the people that they are, mm-hmm. And how they were created by the world that they live in. I think it really interesting that you specifically said that the mayor is this sort of paper cutout. You only meet him, what, once?
Yeah, once.
In the entire novel. He's just kind of this looming figure in the background who, you know, owns the entire city and controls the, I'm giving a little bit away, but not very much, the RTK, which is, what is it, the Reformation?
Turkish Kurdistan.
Yeah. The
morality police.
The morality police, exactly. Yeah. But he's kind of in the background. And he is just emblematic of all of the wrongs in sort of the very oppressive hardline.
Right. And the idea, by the time you get to the end,
you know, without giving too much away, the fact that a figurehead is a figurehead, and that it's the institution and this need to scapegoat and hate for whatever reason gives people a sense of safety. And that has happened in various countries in the Middle East. That's also happened in America.
Mm-hmm.
And many Western countries and areas, even state by state, we see that happening right now.
Yeah.
With
Western
the election
countries.
Coming by. Yeah, and I think that, again, if you sat, that's why I found it so interesting to make sure that Daria and Rakai met. Because they're not that different.
No, not at all.
They're actually just the other side of the same piece of paper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But one's a man and one's a woman. And one has experienced the world in one sense, and the other has experienced the world from another sense. And the difference there is so profound that it has shaped them into extremes.
Yeah. Now I'm glad you brought that up, that aspect of safety, because you actually go into a little bit of detail about what has happened to the city after Rakai's parents die. The money stops flowing, essentially. There's not – the schools close. The societal sort of things that people had come to rely on are gone. And it's in that vacuum that the RTK and the mayor can take control. And it's in that sort of, you know
– The anthropological sort of motivations of people when there's not economic opportunities is that they end up, you know, having to take jobs like in the RTK,
mm-hmm.
Where it maintains a certain level of safety for themselves and their families. Things like the Taliban gained as much influence in Afghanistan as they did.
Absolutely. But it also gives people, because there's an institution there that they're committing to, and because there aren't other opportunities, it gives them an excuse.
Yes.
So if you look at the character of Fahri, he knows that it's wrong. And when he's forced to look at what's going on in the city around him, not only does he know that he's wrong, but he wants to change it.
Right.
But when he's not forced to look at it, because it is the status quo, not only does he go along with it, but he's the one perpetuating it.
Right.
And it makes you want to just punch him in the nose. But I think that's part of what makes him such an interesting character.
Yeah, I really was drawn towards him more than a lot of other characters. You mentioned just now being forced to look at things, and I think that is the sort of purpose of that initial incredibly explicit scene with Rakai and Rebecca and other characters in the RTK. Where Rakai is finally forced to deal with what his world has become.
Yes. Yes, I think that's very true. And I have received some criticism for making it quite so explicit. And your listeners, you know, definitely should know this is an adult novel. There is a graphic rape scene in the first 20% of the book. And it's done on purpose. And the reason why it's done is this shocks Rakai out of his comfort zone. It shocks him out of what he thinks the world he lives in is like. He's been overseas. He's been educated. He has no idea that the city he grew up in is really like this. He hears stories, but who believes that? And then he really has to experience it. I wanted the reader to understand and feel for themselves. If you don't feel the true depth of what Rakai saw and experienced with Rebecca, then how can you understand the rage and the confusion that he goes through later?
Yeah, there is something too about that particular scene is that Rakai is helpless. He literally can't do anything.
Right.
Because, and I'm not going to say why he can't do anything. That you should read it, you'll find out. And I think that has a lot to do with it too. Is there are things in his past where that keep now have started to resurface, in which he's helpless.
And also factor in that Rakai, when not in those helpless situations, is a badass. You know, he's not a superhero from Krypton. He was in the military. He was part of a guerrilla commando. He grew up wrestling professionally. Like, he's tough. And then to be put in this situation of being completely impotent is devastating.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that sort of that, you know, impotency, it actually is really how he's been for most of his life. Yeah, he's tough. Yeah, he's done these things and he's been in the military and whatnot. But his actual actions in terms of the city, he hasn't done anything. And he doesn't feel like he can do anything because somehow he doesn't stand up to, you know, the ideal his parents set. This is just the first time that he's being forced to deal with that
aspect
of his life. It was a good scene in a very troubling sort of. It worked for me. I thought about it. I hope everybody else does too. But
yeah, it is. It was a hard scene to read. So I appreciated that was not one of the scenes that you wrote for 15 pages about.
No, that's not one that I dwelled on, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I think that would be really hard to have done that in the book, because that would have made the book like irreparably dark. I knew something when I was reading there. I was like, this is not going to go the way I think it's going to go. It's going to go completely opposite.
Yeah, this isn't going to be like, the Islamic boy falls in love with the Jewish girl, and isn't it wonderful, and they all live happily ever after. This book. And there are those books, and they're beautiful books, and they're out there, and I can recommend many of them. This one isn't that, though.
Yeah, and I was almost hoping for that because I knew what was coming. I'm going, oh, this, can we just stay with this for another couple of pages and that would be nice? And then no, you're like, oh.
Yeah, well, that was the trick. Not the trick, not like a trick back, but that was the real challenge in writing it, is to bring the parts that do make you smile. You know, like Hassad cracks me up. I think Hassad is like the best character I've ever written. He's, you know, constantly giving Rakai a hard time and calling him a petulant child and throwing things at him and just like generally being an old grump. And I find Daria in her own way to be extremely charming and extremely charismatic. And you almost find yourself rooting for her at times, even though you know that you shouldn't be.
Yeah, I agree.
I thought she was a really fascinating character, but you know, intelligent, ambitious, but she's more than I think any of the other characters, including Isik. She's the one that's really hit that wall of the societal constraints, and but at the same time, you know, she's also wildly misogynist, and the wall has kind of created her to sort of empathize with the males in power.
She's taking it on. She's right. And it's almost like a Stockholm syndrome kind of situation where she's taken the mantle of the oppression on herself.
Right.
And perpetuates it. I think you'll be interested to see in book two, where we do learn more about Isik, how much being half Jewish in an Islamic country has affected him.
Mm. Right. Well, the abandonment, and I can imagine it was pretty tough, and I hope I didn't just give a huge spoiler there, but...
No, you know what? It's a book that you certainly don't want to just give everything away about, but it's also not a whodunit. I mean, we know who did it.
Right. I'm curious why you chose Daria as the sort of villain's journey to mirror Rakai's hero's journey.
The book, although most people don't see it at first, but many do understand, this is actually a book about women.
Right.
It's actually a book about three women, Rebecca, Daria, and Mariam, and their story and what it means to be in the different stages of acceptance and understanding of Islamic culture. However, in order to place this book where I wanted to place it and expose the very particular issues that I wanted to expose, I couldn't write it from the point of view of a woman.
Mm.
It had to be the hero had to be a man. It had to be a man who came to understand the injustice and who is the one to come to fix it, which still holds on to the basic misogynistic issues that I'm trying to address.
Right.
It's still there in our hero just by his mere existence. But he has access and the ability in a way that a woman never could in the culture. I mean, the scene where Miriam's simply trying to buy a newspaper.
Yeah.
And she has to practically, you know, beg and flirt herself just to get a copy of a newspaper.
Yeah.
Which is not typical of Islamic culture. That is not typical of Islamic countries or Muslim ideas on education. There are places where it happens, though.
Right.
And I found it really necessary for Daria to be the bad guy, as opposed to, for example, Issik, Darian Issik.
Right.
It really had to be a woman who was perpetuating the evil in order to highlight the difference between the experiences of the three women and how those experiences shaped who Daria was.
Right.
That's interesting.
That's actually one of the things that I found really important to me in addressing women in the Muslim culture was the different reactions to the hijab. And Daria really chafes against it. She hates it. It's the worst thing in the world to her. But Miriam accepts it as part of her faith and, you know, that it's important to her. And there's kind of been, you know, an interesting conversation about that in the world as a whole. The fact that the hijab can be both a tool of oppression, which it is to Daria, but it can also be a sort of a thing of liberation. Is she still there? Please tell me she's still there.
Yes, I'm still here. I'm listening.
Okay, thank God. Just to make sure that I wasn't talking to nobody.
Because you sound smart. We don't want to have to cut that part out.
Anyway, so if for Miriam, it is. It is more of a tool of liberation. And there was years ago, there was an interesting interview with a woman who basically came out, and this was in the United States, who wears the hijab. She doesn't wear the veil, but she you know, for her, she wears it. It's her choice. I mean, and that's a really important aspect of religion. When it becomes, it's only a tool for oppression when it's not a choice. And she wears it because she feels it puts her on an equal playing field as men. And I found it interesting that Daria, you know, doesn't ever see it that way. She sees it as a tool, and therefore it becomes this thing that she must fight against. Miriam actually at one point mentions how she's uncomfortable in her nurse's clothing because it's so thin and
she can't wear her abaya over it.
Right. I thought that was absolutely fascinating to have those two different viewpoints on such kind of a basic tenet of Islam.
And that very much was one of the primary things I was trying to convey, in to make it clear that the hijab itself, the prescription from the Quran of modesty, and however that may be interpreted by each individual, is not a bad thing.
Right.
Religion and living your religion and wearing your religion, that's a beautiful thing. Where it gets problematic is the institution. It often is, you know, will you obey the laws of God or do you obey the laws of man? And that's the basic question that all of the characters have to ask themselves when it comes to whether they're going to help Rakai or not. Because in helping him become the sandstorm, they're breaking the laws of man. But I think that I posit that by fighting against that oppression, they are following the law of God as it is being spoken to them in those moments. I also just want to add in, I love your interpretation of the two women. I want to add in Rebecca, and that she's Jewish. She has no need to wear a burqa or a hijab, or this is not her culture. The burqa she's not very happy about when she has to put it on.
Right.
But of her own very generous nature, when she realizes that Rakai is Muslim, covers her hair.
Yeah.
And it is a sign of respect, and it is a sign of she's not being oppressed or dominated in any way. This is something she's decided to do to show him that he is welcome in their home.
Right.
Yeah. And I think
it's three outlooks when you put them together, hopefully create it doesn't answer the question, but it creates a way of looking at the question of hijab and the question of women in the Middle East mm-hmm. that you can think about a little bit deeper than just jumping to the assumption, which I think many Western women do, that yes. because they are covering, they are oppressed.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that has a lot to do, too, with there is a very tiny population of Muslim followers and believers and people and immigrants in places like the United States. I don't know about Canada, but I'm just going to say United States. And I think some of that has to do with if you aren't interacting with people, I mean, it's really hard for you to sort of understand who they are from a cultural perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we sort of get the myths are perpetuated on our news. And I found like, you know, I sort of bought into a lot of that before I started meeting people and realizing, wait, you're not anything like what I've been told to believe. Right. And then you start meeting these people and you realize like, wait, we both like Star Wars and we both like Mexican food. Like,
yeah. And your world is open to some really beautiful, fascinating, wonderful people who are expressing their beliefs in a way that's meaningful to them. And I'm sure that you have beliefs that you express in a different way that is meaningful to you, just like I do. You know, I'm not Muslim. I don't wear hijab. You know, I'm a Unitarian. But it's that doesn't mean that, you know, for me, even just in writing this book and putting myself out there in order to have to discuss a culture that I am not a part of, is an expression of what I believe. And what I believe is that when you get really down to it, we're all people and we're all a creation of our circumstances. And terrorist or pacifist or, you know, from Japan or from Australia, if we sit down and we just talk, more than likely we have something in common.
Yeah, we all like Star Wars and Mexican food.
Totally.
See?
I'll be at your place Friday night.
Awesome.
That does sound like an awesome Friday night.
You did just bring up an interesting question, which I did not know that you yourself are not Muslim. And so I guess my question is, did you do a lot of research on Muslim culture or how for you? Because I guess the question I'm getting at is, are you worried about representing a kind of quote-unquote authenticity in terms of your representation?
Absolutely. It was extremely important to me to be as authentic as possible, and both in representing people honestly and owning whatever of my own preconceived notions I may have brought into this. And I'm sure I have. I just haven't found them yet, but I'm sure they're there and someone will point them out to me. I was very lucky to have many Muslim friends who looked over it and read it to make sure that I was using phraseology correctly and that I was understanding the hadiths and the quotes from the Quran, the surahs that I was using to make my points. I did a tremendous amount of research into Islam and Turkey in particular. I've been studying comparative religion since I was in college. And have been interested in Islam for a very long time. So it wasn't, not that it wasn't a challenge, but it wasn't a new area of study for me in order to read the book, to write the book.
Okay. That's fascinating. So in a lot of ways, it was very fortunate to have been around a lot of people who have various beliefs and the like, because you then had people you could actually talk to. And have these conversations about, you know, understanding their culture and perhaps even of sharing that cultural experience, which clearly I think has some reflection in your work, that you see a lot of the melding of cultures, the different forms of culture kind of sometimes at odds in your book, but sometimes trying to sort of find a way to coexist. Which
and
I
that's
think
one of the reasons why I chose Turkey.
as the play, the location of the book. Turkey is, this is not what Turkey is really like. Anybody who reads this book and hears this interview, please don't think that Turkey is actually like what I wrote. It's not. But I chose the location for two reasons. The first is because Turkey really is a nexus. You know, is it a Western country or is it a Middle Eastern country? Is it an Islamic country? Is it a Jewish country? Because there's a large Jewish population there. There's some people who even say it's partially a Christian country. There's Turks, there's Kurds, there's Assyrians, there's like just a tremendous amount of diversity there. And it's also mostly a secular country, even though Islam is obviously very strongly a part of their governmental process. So it seemed to me like a very perfect place because it's already an amalgamation of different cultures and languages and histories. And then there's also the fact that if you take the city Ila, Turkey, and you put it into Google and you search, do you know what you find?
I do, but I cheated.
What
did
you
do it just now?
No. I read the last 30 pages in the ebook, which had some interviews. I won't give the big spoiler though. You go ahead and do that because it's really cool.
Oh my goodness.
Ila is actually the Kurdish word for the city. It is the old word, and it's part of a society that doesn't exist anymore. The city's been renamed. So if you went to Turkey and asked for Ila, they'd look at you like you were crazy. It's actually a city that is called Batman. There is a city in Turkey called Batman, Turkey.
Yeah.
Batman, Turkey has actually sued Warner Brothers for use of their name. They lost.
I remember that, yes. Oh, so funny.
And I just couldn't resist.
Oh my goodness, that is hilarious.
Conveniently, it's also a city that gives you, I mean, how much of the story was inspired by the location and how much is it just, you know, you just putting it in because you needed it to be there?
I think a lot of it is inspired by the location. You know, I did not realize that there was a population of Bangladeshi Jews in eastern Turkey until I started researching it. And then that becomes a relatively important part of the story.
Right.
So I was definitely influenced as I wrote, the more I researched into the location. Hmm. But I chose Batman, Turkey before I started writing. I mean, come on. That's awesome.
That is awesome. Oh, fun factoids about the world. Yay. Alrighty, so we got to get to our quick five and start to wrap it up. Our quick five, by the way, they're just silly questions. But one of them will make you think really hard, but you have to answer quickly because that's just the way I do this. So,
oh, no.
So question one is sand or water?
Water.
Okay. Camel or horse?
Horse.
Okay. This is interesting. Bruce Wayne's Batman Playhouse or superpowers like in Marvel?
Superpowers.
Oh, okay. Heroine or anti-hero?
Anti-hero.
Okay, and the last one, if you had your nemesis right where you wanted them, right, would you capture them and lock them up forever or drop a neutron bomb capable of disassembling said nemesis molecule by molecule? Would you drop that on them?
Yes.
The latter?
Yep. Yep, I'd kill the bastard. Is that the one I'm supposed to think about? What does that say about
emotional stability? At least for another second.
Yeah, no, there's no hesitation there.
Wow.
I have kids. I'd kill the bastard.
Yeah, right.
That's an awful death.
Would it be? I mean, at least if they're getting disassembled, they might not feel much.
I don't know.
It sounds like, though, from the questions you asked me, all of my answers are diametrically opposed to the book I wrote, which is interesting.
Yes,
it is. It's very interesting. Okay, so where can people find you? Like, are you doing any convention appearances, readings, or, you know, you have a website that you'd like people to go to?
Yeah, I'm online, Pavardi K. Tyler. You can look me up at pavardi.com or find me on pretty much any social media site under the full name, Pavardi K. Tyler. I'm going to be in New York, actually, in June. And June 7th at Blue Stockings Activist Center and Bookstore, I'll be doing a reading and hosting a kind of book party. Not quite a launch event, but a book party there, which will be really exciting. It's 7 p.m. at Blue Stockings in New York City.
Oh, fantastic.
So if you're anywhere near Manhattan, stop on by. It'll be fun to see everybody.
Yeah, that'll be great. I don't live anywhere near Manhattan.
We'll make Mike go. Mike can go in our store.
Oh, he is in New York. Oh, yeah, yep. Michael, problem solved.
That would be great. I mean, it's neat.
He's become our target.
It's neat in the bookstores that I've contacted, the ones that are interested in Shadow. It seems it's a combination of just small town indie bookstores that think it sounds kind of cool and activist centers. The kind of middle of the road bookstores don't, I'm not sure if they don't want to take the risk on it or if they just don't think it'll appeal to their readers, but it's been fun working with the indie bookstores.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I wish you best of luck with it for sure. Cause it's a very interesting book and folks should get it. It's called Shadow on the Wall, book one of the Sandstorm Chronicles. It's pretty kick-ass. It's also got a really nice cover, by the way.
Thank you. That's Damon Zeta. He's brilliant. He does all my covers. Hire him if you are an author.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a really cool cover. It's got this ink blocky kind of... you have to just look at it. I'm not going to describe it because that's just kind of pointless. Just look at it. It's cool. So thank you so much, Pavardi, for coming on our show. We really appreciate it.
Great. Well, I really appreciate the invitation. It was really fun to meet you both.
And you too. And hopefully when the next book comes out, you'll keep in touch.
I will.
We should find out what happens
soon.
To him. Definitely.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Fart in your general direction!
France. Different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.